It's time now for the future, because the future is, after all, right now.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Okay, welcome back. And that may be one of the last times you hear that intro, because on vacation, we have vowed to create a new intro for ourselves.
Dr. We shall see. Mrs. Future.
Yes. So while we were at IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, gathering, celebrating the Apollo 11 landing 50 years ago this weekend, we ran into some old friends, Connie and Andrew Bailey and Connie Baxter. I think we had them on about 9 years ago on the show. And at that time, you guys were about to embark on your latest adventure, which I believe in your golden years, shall we say, you went mobile. You sold your houses and went into a very nice Mercedes RV and started traveling around the country.
And touring the hot spots in the country.
While you were writing, meeting interesting people and writing.
Consciousness Central to Consciousness Central.
Yeah. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Great to be back.
And all right.
Great to be with you,
too. Yeah, love Santa Cruz. I arrived in Santa Cruz 50 years ago this year, so I met Ralph Abraham, your beloved friend of mine. We just had lunch together.
Yes, he's been on the show many times.
I know.
Oh, and you are actually a part of the HIP History Project.
We are a part of the HIP Santa Cruz Project, and met Ralph in London in 1969, and this is 2019, so that's 50 years ago, which is kind of... Oh, my goodness, inducing.
Yes, my goodness, right?
It started Andrew's magical mystery tour.
That's right, you were from South Africa originally, right?
I grew up in South Africa. I was born in England, actually, in 1943. That'll give you a hint as to my vintage.
Yes.
Yeah, and family moved to South Africa when I was 3, so I actually turned 4 in South Africa and left when I was 25.
Wow.
And sailed across the Atlantic and came in search of cosmic consciousness and California girls and all these other gorgeous...
You heard about California, even from South Africa.
Oh, man,
right?
California girls got a bit of a rep out there with the Beach Boys, you know?
Yeah, the Beach Boys were... I guess you have surfing in South Africa, right?
We certainly do have really good surfing. I ended up with a girl from Maine because I learned that you come here to California and nobody's from California. Everybody's from...
Somewhere else.
Maine. Yeah, some of them are from Maine.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
Some of us.
And Connie, you were not a recent immigrant. I mean, your family goes back to the Mayflower, right?
Yep, 12 generations Mayflower, and that's a lot of the work we do to bring that story forward, because it's so shrouded in misconception and misunderstanding.
So you feel like you represent the real American mythos, the story of coming from the original vision of what America was.
That original vision, which was a huge leap in consciousness for humanity, what the Mayflower pilgrims did standing up against the King of England. It was treasonous to do that. They took a huge step for humanity. And when they got here, they met with the Native Americans, formed a peace treaty, and lived in peace and friendship for 54 years. And we...
Two generations, huh?
Yeah, and we're saying that synthesis gave birth to the American mind, spirit, and democracy. So that's a big part of the work that we're doing.
And that was present years later when the Declaration of Independence was written. And
we're calling the first 50 years of peace and friendship in Plymouth the first great synthesis between European colonists and the American Indians.
1620
to 1675. And then the second great synthesis was when the great law came of the Iroquois came into the Constitution, aspects of the great law of the
Iroquois.
When
did that happen?
1787 was when the Constitution. So we call that the second great synthesis, and now we're calling for a third great synthesis now, which is happening through the environmental crisis, that we're coming to open our hearts and minds to what the indigenous peoples know about the nature of the universe and about the earth and about how to live in alignment.
So once again, we're integrating indigenous wisdom with European.
Exactly. Planet. It's a synthesis. We're saying, it's a synthesis. It's not carried by any one color of man. It's a synthesis of us all coming together And that's what our work is about with our book, The Trust Frequency, 10 Assumptions for a New Paradigm.
Okay, so you're redefining what American consciousness is, where it's going in the future, or how it could go from where it is now to...
Yeah, I think it's realistic to say that Western materialistic culture has become disconnected from, shall we say, Gaia or Mother Nature. And the native peoples of the world have remained connected while it's been really, really a rough millennium for them, or however long it's been. They're more connected than we are.
To nature.
So part of what happened at IONS, for example, there was a wonderful woman named Pat McCabe who just put out this beautiful, beautiful call for return to Mother Earth and return to Gaia. It sounds like the old hippie movement that I came over to join here 50 years ago. Because back then, that's what we were not.
Yeah,
we were speaking of exactly that. Back to the earth, back to the land, back to beauty, back to wear some flowers in your hair, you know? Come on, let's remember who we really are. And we're not industrial robots, you know?
We're not machines. We're actually stewards of living systems.
Well, the way I understand it is that because of the 19th century technology, which was kind of repetitious to make stuff, we had to train people to be repetitious in the way that they thought about jobs and such. But now we're going through a major revolution with our AI, robotics, computers.
Yeah, we can offload all the repetitious stuff to the AIs and go back to being
what it means to be human.
Humans.
Yeah. I think that's part of what's coming.
Before the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
And that's
we're in the post-industrial revolution, which is a revelation.
Let the robots do the work and let's do what we do best, which is, in your estimation and your exploration of the last 10 years that we've seen you, does America look good? Does it look like we're having a new evolution of consciousness in this
country? From my perspective, the American dream turned into American nightmare. But, you know,
that's what we hear on the news.
That's what seems to be. Certainly on the surface, it looks that way to me.
So your travels have confirmed your worst fears?
No, that's not really the travels. If I were simply to travel and not look at the news or anything, I would have a different perspective. I think there are elements and aspects of this country and people and who and how they are that are really, really wonderful and evolutionary and growing. The circles we move in are extraordinary, such as this conference this weekend and on. We're part of a group called the Evolutionary Leaders, and extraordinary visions and plans and ideas for the future and realities for right now. So good, strong stuff.
Well, in my opinion, the American dream, the American promise that the founders saw a potential for humanity, and it's in our Constitution. The Mayflower Pilgrims saw it. They met with the Native Americans who embody it, and we have yet to realize it, and we're in process. And the American dream is our birthright. It's absolute. It is equality, justice, abundance for all. It's our birthright, and it's a process to get there, to live it.
And we're going through the next phase of bringing it into existence.
Exactly, from my perspective.
Continue exploring this after the break, talking to Connie and Andrew Bailey and Connie Baxter Marlowe.
Good man.
So if you want to get to heaven, you're going to raise a little hell. Will you agree with that?
I say welcome to paradise, as famous Max Hartstein used to say every opportunity he got.
Let's see. I just ran into this. We all sit in God's classroom. All we need to do is stop throwing spitballs.
Okay, that'll do. I can go along
with
that.
Maybe a few spitballs get people's attention.
Well, that's it.
The ones who are asleep. You know, you get hit with a spitball, man, you're going to wake up.
I don't know. I think maybe the ones who are asleep are the ones throwing the spitballs, you know?
Depends on your perspective.
Yeah, the perspective that's come up for the last couple of shows is we've been celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. And that was a time in the American consciousness was hopeful, was really optimistic about the future, about something that we achieved together and brought us together, and we're proud of being an American. at that point. And I guess what we're missing today is having something on that level that brings us all together to feel like it's great to what we're doing on this planet.
Yeah, we had a nice 50-year run of optimism, and now here we are in the depths of despair again.
Now, what's real here? I mean, at the same time, I'm hearing that we create our own narrative, that what we tell ourselves is what we create for ourselves, and have a more optimistic narrative, and you'll have a more optimistic life.
Oh, as I was saying over the break, if we can focus on the fact that when people talk about the dastardly media leading us all down this garden path of doom and gloom and the end of the world and thinking how horrible everything is, we're talking about maybe as many as 1,000 voices a week in some kind of mainstream career where they're being dictated a particular story to sell for whatever reason. And we have millions, hundreds of millions of people who actually have their own story that gets influenced by that, but actually doesn't show the same picture.
So how do you get news about your books, The Trust Frequency?
Yeah, how do we get the good news out about people such as yourself?
Mayflower Revelations, a deep book, a huge book on Mayflower Revelations. Yeah. These are the memes that you guys are referring to here, right? How do you get those memes out there in the world?
I think it's really interesting to start with the 50-year perspective of 50 years ago this week, the landing on the moon, the first walking on the moon. And I was living in London at the time, and we all got together, a whole bunch of us, bunch of South Africans, bunch of English people, and we all gathered together and stayed because it was in the middle of the night, and we stayed up all night, and we watched that thing, and we paid total attention, and we weren't proud to be Americans because we weren't Americans.
Yeah, but you were a human.
But we were
right?
proud, exactly.
Yeah, that was the connection.
We were proud to be humans. There was an evolutionary sense of getting somewhere, of making progress. And the potential of what we were, I don't think we articulated it, but I think we had this sense, this inner sense, that something was going on that was important, that was exciting, and that was leading somewhere positive for humanity.
And it was inclusive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It was something that we could be all proud of together.
We pushed the frontier just a
and
little
let's bit. Let's remember that that was the 60s, and that was 1969, which for me was a pivotal year. It was the year in which my entire reality changed, the year during which, at the end of the year, I sailed a sailboat across the Atlantic and found myself here in Santa Cruz, California, 3 months later. And that act on my part changed my life. And the fact that I ended up settling here in Santa Cruz, my first address on this side of the Atlantic was 45 Main Street, SoCal, and ended up living up in Boulder Creek that summer. And the most beautiful place on the planet. My heart still lives.
1969?
1960. I actually got here to Santa Cruz January 12th, 1970.
Looking for cosmic consciousness.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And you found it, right?
That was part
right
of,
here
that was,
in
that
Santa
was a big
Cruz.
Part of the. You're Canadian. That was a term that came out of Canada.
Did it? I mean, cosmic consciousness was
good? It did. It's,
really?
It's a Canadian term. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so be proud. Be proud.
Which part of Canada?
I don't know. It was a particular thinker, philosopher, and this term cosmic consciousness became this buzzword. I think I might have read about it in something like a Life magazine in South Africa in probably 1967, and I said, hey, I'm going there. And we'd had the Summer of Love. There was all of this stuff going on.
All that happening. I'd be curious if it was Montreal. I was in that area at the time.
Uh-huh.
It became out.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll investigate that.
Yeah.
We have a caller. You'd like to talk to a caller, you guys?
Whoa.
Sure.
Okay.
All right.
What
do we have, Mrs. Future?
We have Rich in Live Oak. Hi, Rich in Live Oak. Do you have a...
Yes, hi.
Do you want to engage our guests at all?
What do you got in mind?
What do you think?
Well, I had an idea about the moon landings.
Yeah?
Okay.
You remember Apollo 13?
Yeah,
that was where they had to circle around. They had a disaster. They weren't able to complete the mission. Yeah.
Yeah, on the way to the moon, the oxygen tank in the command module exploded.
Yeah.
Right. There's a big movie on that. I think Ron Howard directed it.
But my observation is that when they decided to all get into the LEM, the lunar lander, actually, there wasn't enough room for three people in that lunar lander. So they were going to use the oxygen out of the lunar lander on the way back. And then just before they got to the Earth, they were going to switch back to the command module.
Where they could fit more comfortably.
But I have a question. How did they get three people in that lunar lander when there was only room for two?
Well, I guess that's what you call survival skills.
Well, in the 60s, I guess, how many people could you fit in a Volkswagen?
Yeah. You know? I mean, that generation was trying to fit a bunch of people in a phone booth. I'm sure they could figure out a lunar lander, depended on it.
I was in Africa at the time. The question was, how do you get five elephants in a VW? And the answer was two in the front, three in the back, right? However, my friend, caller, that was obviously challenging. I personally have no idea how they pulled that off, but they made it, didn't they? They made it back.
They did. They made it back. And good question. I think watching the movie Apollo 13 might reveal that.
So humans are unbelievably capable of surviving under the most difficult of conditions. And I personally feel that we face some of the most enormous challenges right now that our species has ever faced. I mean, the last ice age, we got down to maybe as few as 1,000 humans. And here we are at something like 7.5 billion. And yet, as a result of that massive number of humans, we seem to be finding ourselves facing the potential of not making it. There's a serious challenge.
Yeah. There's some serious challenges out there. There's another one that just came out. One of my neurophysiologist buddies posted it. And it has to do with our physiology. It has to do with that the idea that we should be happy all the time is not necessarily true biologically. That our species is hardwired for survival and for procreation, for making copies of itself. And whatever it takes to do those two things, to keep us alive and keep us multiplying. And happiness is
secondary at best.
Yeah. And
right.
Chasing happiness.
We're much more.
The dream of being happy. It's a very American concept.
The pursuit of happiness.
Yes, right. It's included to that. Mm. It's one of the unalienable rights, right? That's what supposedly we.
Yet it's a latecomer to the biology.
So I've been looking at this article in more depth to see if there's anything really
to it.
Well,
we feel that we actually come here to align with our divinity, that actually we go through various processes, we get wounds, we are unhappy, we get in touch with our shadow as a collective, as an individual, and so we're not hardwired to be happy, we're hardwired to go on our soul's journey to wholeness, which is to face the parts of ourselves we don't love yet. And so circumstances and people come into our lives that make us miserable because we ask for them to come to show us the parts of ourselves we don't love yet. Yeah. And so the whole concept of being happy all the time and smiling and don't cry and don't feel is anathema to the human spirit and to the human journey, and that we have to allow ourselves to be unhappy, to be in crisis, to feel grief, to feel it all, so that we can come into a higher way of being.
Hmm. So you're talking about shallow happiness as opposed to satisfied, fulfilled happiness.
Yeah.
You're talking about happiness where you're just denying pain.
Right. And we're talking happiness where you're aligned with your true purpose, the why you came here. You've processed all the jobs you came here to process, meaning all the wounds you came here to get. We're living in another reality of the fact that we are all aspects of the divine, and that we are here on a soul's journey, that we come into this plane for work to do, to align with our divinity and bring heaven to earth.
What is it? Spirits of the Material World.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. Beautiful police song of that title.
That's right. That's right. So, but that was part of your 60s divinity that came in as well, was that incorporated that idea that it's all divine.
And it is. There ain't nothing else. There's no other place to be.
Well, you know, they say God is love.
Yeah.
And God is everything. Everything is God.
A decentralized God, if you will.
So what we present in our book, The Trust Frequency, is that in that case, it's all love. And we actually present a construct on the nature of the universe that resolves the paradox between love and not love, because we have an understanding that the nature of that love is unconditional. And the nature of unconditional love is that it gives us everything we ask for. So, in that case, what are our requests to this conscious, loving universe? And we say that it's seven aspects of our consciousness.
got 15 seconds or wait a few minutes.
Let's start with awareness.
With seven.
Aha.
Get away. Well, these are big concepts, man.
These are big concepts, man.
Back after the break.
Each one of them is... Okay, welcome back. Nice lazy Tuesday afternoon here in Santa Cruz in the middle of July. Beautiful time of day.
We were sort of bookmarked on the trust frequency there.
With Connie Baxter, Marlowe, and Andrew Bailey.
Yeah, I want to just give you some compliments that your quality of consciousness is something I always love because you are very positive, high vibration oriented. You're very evolutionary. You're very focused on human potential. And these things are wonderful. And you have put together this beautiful book called The Trust Frequency, which I know has been out now about 10 years. And in that journey, why did you write The Trust Frequency? What was missing that made you address this particular set of ideas?
Well, I personally saw that humanity was out of balance. And I felt that our current paradigm was missing information. So I asked the question, what are the missing pieces of the paradigm that has us out of balance?
Who did you ask?
The universe. And the answers you get depend on the questions you ask. And I went looking to Europe and found our same paradigm in Europe. And I came back and in a bookstore in Santa Fe, New Mexico, I picked up a book of Native American poetry and got it, that 500 Indian nations had clues to a bigger paradigm, to a bigger understanding of the nature of the universe.
Are you saying that the indigenous Native Americans regularly talk to the universe?
Oh, yeah, big time.
They do.
Oh, yeah. And then visionary elders started coming into my life to show me these missing pieces of the paradigm.
Well, you see, that is a paradigm shift for average Americans.
That's right.
To me, it's the intersection of where science meets shamanism.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what our book is. Indigenous Cosmology, Quantum Science Synthesis. Because quantum science is now proving or pointing to what the indigenous peoples know about the nature of the universe.
Yeah, so connecting directly with nature is the primary way of connecting with the universe.
Yeah, and not only with nature. Yeah. It's way bigger than that.
Galaxies themselves.
It's interdimensional. It's galaxies. Yes. It's way bigger than the Earth and nature.
Inner worlds and outer worlds.
It's actually the mechanics of the universe. How does the universe
work? Really? Like a cosmic Google?
Yeah. In quantum science, with the observer effect, that we actually create the reality by observing it. I mean, this is huge. And the Native people know that. And they know that we're all interconnected, that our thoughts totally influence the weather, totally influence everything. That's what we're bringing forth in this book, is this synthesis of understanding that we live in a conscious, loving, abundant universe.
And that was kind of what Ions was talking about when Edgar Mitchell saw the Earth as a whole from space, and he saw how it was all connected and not divided.
That's right. I mean, that's literally must be so mind-blowing to be out there and actually to be able to look out of the window and see the entire beautiful blue planet with no borders, no nations, none of that stuff is visible. It's all this kind of fantasy that we humans have made up.
Yeah.
Right. And it's they're now calling it a samadhi, mm-hmm. which is a moment of profound realization beyond words, of a higher truth.
Well, I guess you're sitting there and, you know, people are talking about what they're going to do when they get home and, you know, see your wives and your kids and whether or not the splashdown is going to be a problem or whatnot, and thinking all the details. And what Edgar had to his advantage then is that he had done his job. He had been the commander to the moon. He had landed them on the moon. He's get to relax a little bit on the way back to Earth. So he get to look out the window a little bit more than the other guys. And I think
sort
that's
like
what it took.
Sort of like after an orgasm, right? His mind is open and he can just...
He did his job. He's relaxed. Yeah. And then you see this thing floating out there. And everyone else is kind of not really talking about it that much. They're dealing with tomorrow or what's going to happen next. And he has a chance to just see that ball floating there. And
that blue marble.
Something that none of us had ever seen before. as a whole in real time like that.
And apparently a lot of the other astronauts have had similar experiences, yeah, but they're not up for talking about it.
Well, it's not exactly normal conversation.
Yeah, and either they feel that it's to their disadvantage somehow within the current structure to
appreciate the beauty of where we're
from. To go there, that they had these extraordinary experiences. I don't know, but that's what the head of IONS was saying. They can't get other astronauts to step up and speak about this experience.
Well, different people, I think, are oriented differently around the idea of expanded awareness. Some people can really exalt in it and feel that it's the most satisfying aspect of existence. Some people feel like it's something that the church is trying to teach and that you need to take it with a grain of salt, or there's just individual temperament is so different around relating to expanded awareness, right?
But it's becoming more normal now, from what I can see. When you're traveling across the country, did you have a lot of cosmic conversations with people?
With people out there in the middle of the cornfields in Kansas?
Yeah, it's not, you didn't have to go to California?
There's no people out there.
It's still only here.
Who's in the middle of the cornfields in Kansas?
A whole
bunch
of corn stalks and some crows.
Dorothy.
I see.
Dorothy. We ran into Dorothy.
Really?
A real Dorothy?
No.
Oh.
Well, and she said cosmic consciousness. Of course. We pulled back the veil. We pulled back that curtain, and there he was.
With his little projector system.
Yes, you saw the wizard, did you?
No, wizard whizzing along.
Let's see. You know, I want to just stay on the trust frequency assumptions that we were going to express before the break and just go down here. So we're talking about expanded awareness. We're talking about accurate assumptions. So let me just give you a moment to talk about accurate assumptions versus inaccurate assumptions. What kinds of things are people believing that are in the way of the trust frequency?
All right, so the essence of this work that we've placed into this book, The Trust Frequency, the basic question is, how do we live from a place of trust, of total unconditional trust, versus a place of fear based on the world that we look out there and see today? How do we actually operate as a human being? And what is our operating system? Our operating system is actually our beliefs, our assumptions. An assumption is simply a belief that we take to be true without questioning it.
Well, did you carry a gun in your RV?
Nope. Do not.
Oh.
There you go. That tells your belief system a little bit there.
Let's see.
Yeah.
When you start talking about assumptions, I think of this great line from The Odd Couple. When you have assumptions, you make an ass out of you and me. Right.
I've heard that one. Ask you me.
That's another level of assumptions. These are axioms. These are core assumptions about the nature of the universe.
Could you be really specific here? Because I'm very curious which assumptions you think we could embrace or let go of.
Well, let's see. What is it? The universe loves loving you?
There's that. How about the universe itself? I'm a science guy, right? I'm a chemical engineer, and I've got a degree in mathematics and physics. So I was really trained to believe that this universe
is a
giant mechanical system of some sort. It includes quarks and electrons and galaxies and everything that material science.
But not
teaches.
Exactly alive.
So would you call that an accurate assumption?
Yeah.
That is correct from a certain very limited perspective.
So it's an incomplete, accurate assumption.
So if my assumption is that I live in a, shall we say, a lifeless universe, it contains life, but it's not alive.
That's where it becomes inaccurate.
It's not alive.
We're living organisms on a giant rock.
Right.
Do that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. Now, if, to the contrary, if we are actually an inextricable part of a giant living organism.
Including the rocks.
That includes absolutely everything, every quark, every whisper within this ever-evolving
universe.
Well, then
it occurs to me, what does it mean to be living at that point?
It means we are aware, we're conscious, and this thing is active. And we're actually evolving, we're changing, we're learning, we're growing. Make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I just want to say, from the IONS conference, I found it very satisfying when Deepak Chopra was addressing this issue of the living universe, when he made a distinction between aspects of the living universe. Living means that it's inherently self-organizing, self-repairing, and going towards its own improvement, survival and
biology does that, but rocks fall apart.
And he said a mechanistic form, which is not alive, is something that is created, and when it breaks, it stops. That there's no self-improvement going on. That was the way that he made the distinction between things that we need to honor their souls.
Entropy.
Because there's a self that is trying to liberate its soul essence versus a machine that follows rules and functions, but once it runs into something that it wasn't prepared for, it doesn't know how to adapt.
Matter is entropic. Entropy is subject to entropy.
And consciousness is the opposite.
A life, a biological life at least, in the classical sense, is anti-entropic. It gets it heads towards it's, more complexity.
Exactly. It's growing and expanding contrary to the second law, and that's just the way it is. Consciousness is based different rules.
Mm-hmm. It is, but is consciousness imbued in everything or just in biological life?
In absolutely everything. There's nothing but consciousness. Consciousness takes material form.
And we have access to this consciousness?
We cannot. There's no escape. There's nowhere else to be. There's only consciousness.
Is it related to the field? This is a field?
It is the field.
These Native Americans, these visionary elders who came into my life, have two-way conversations with rocks. Okay, so it's all conscious, it's all alive, and from our perspective, it's all love. Okay, so it's a conscious, loving universe, not only living, but loving. And Deepak, what he also brought was that it's a perceived universe, okay, that our senses actually create what we see from the wave function, what we bring, it's the observer effect.
Yeah, he was calling it experience. He says matter is the vehicle for experiencing consciousness, and that consciousness is the container for matter experiencing consciousness.
Yeah, and that the different species on the planet have different perceptions, different senses, like eyes. Their eyes are completely different, so their reality is completely different from ours because their eyes are constructed differently. So we're seeing a reality just because of our five senses.
Yeah, just our particular species' point of view and way of processing what we see, too. Because we found that others, like Homo erectus or Neanderthal, fought differently than we did.
One.
All right, more after the break. Okay, welcome back to the show. We're talking to roving evolutionary agents Andrew Cameron Bailey and Connie Baxter Marlowe. Welcome back to the studio, folks. Now, I want to get some of your message out there in the last 15 minutes, specifically on stuff you've been doing and you'd like to see happen next in this living universe. Now, the first thing involves the environment. Okay, now we're all concerned about the environment, some more than others, but overall, it affects us all. So you have put together this plan, Andrew, called the Enviroplex, the heart of a global climate restoration strategy. It looks like a modern-day...
great building where people would love to live.
Yeah, kind of with this big slanted, like half of an A-frame, three stories, and is it an industrial building, or what happens in the Enviroplex?
All right, the first thing I'd really like to say is that I'm a grandfather, and I never want my little grandchildren to learn how close we came to self-destruction in this era of right now, in the year 2019, going on 2020. Mm. I believe we face literally a screaming emergency. I'm not hearing a lot of screams, but I'm seeing a lot of despair. I think that people simply don't know that it's even possible. It's too big. It's inconceivable. They have no guidance to be able to have a vision of a future that doesn't involve serious damage to our climate. If they've been paying attention, if they're part of the deniers who think it's some kind of Chinese hoax or whatever, that's a different story. And there are different takes on it.
All right, so we should do something. What are we going to do?
So the first thing I do is I say, okay, what's the problem? What's the challenge? One of the challenges is we have too much CO2 in the atmosphere.
So let's take it out.
So we have a trillion tons estimated of carbon in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Think of that. I think it was Yogananda who said, there are no problems, only opportunities. So what's the opportunity? Let's make a business opportunity. Let's make a global business opportunity.
Collect the CO2. Yes, we've done some stories on that.
What can we do? What can we do with a trillion tons of carbon if you're thinking as a miner? We don't have
What's
to,
it worth?
We don't have to dig a hole in the ground. We don't have to go to the moon to get CO2. It's here in this room. We can extract it. And chemically, it's very easy to get CO2 out of the atmosphere.
And all we have to do is get everybody to exhale? I mean, how are we going to collect all this CO2?
We are carbon-based beings. What we do is we simply react it with an alkali. So the simplest of chemistry, I learned it at the age of 14, is you take carbon dioxide, react it with, say, sodium hydroxide, a dilute solution of sodium hydroxide. It then converts the CO2 into sodium bicarbonate, from which you can make, for example, baking soda. Mm-hmm. We're not going to go into the baking soda business. So then the question becomes, what can we do with the carbon? Concrete is the single biggest thing that humans use tonnage-wise every year, more concrete than anything else. We can turn it into concrete. If you use calcium hydroxide or calcium oxide, you can turn the CO2 in the atmosphere into limestone, into synthetic limestone, which is a perfect aggregate for concrete. Mm-hmm. So we can actually capture it, keep it, sell it, use it in ways that are useful to humanity.
Mm. Where do you get the calcium from?
We get the calcium from something like gypsum, which is calcium sulfate. So there are many sources of calcium.
So what are you going to do about the heat sink of all that concrete that you create? How are you going to turn that into Charles Eisenstein's solution? Is he's saying that if we really want to help with the planet and global warming aspects, then what we need to do is green the planet. We need forest farming. We need green cities. We need growing things to sequester the carbon, shade the heat, keep the heat from turning every place into hot beds that are changing the weather system. And we need to shade areas and create more plant life to hold the water. And that water is really where we should be focusing our attention, much more than carbon.
Well, like they're
creating
all important.
Cement,
right? I mean, there's a lot of people
is
that can do
actually
stuff.
Contributing yeah. to the heat problem.
Well, look, you know, we can use these molecules to make all kinds of stuff. I think the bottom line is that. But once we fully identify that the carbon's a problem, or carbon dioxide's a problem, then we can do something about it, I think.
And once we realize it's not a problem, it's an opportunity, and we
yeah,
take something that
right.
we're perceiving as waste or excess and turn that into a valuable resource, we've changed
yes.
something.
I've seen some prototypes. There's a group up in British Columbia doing that.
There's something right here in Silicon Valley, a company called Blue Planet, who are doing the concrete thing, for example.
Are they? Okay, wow.
Every one of these buildings, it's an acre building, it's a 45,000 square foot building. Half of it is a green, living, growing, the living machine. It is a greenhouse, vertical farm, and it is generating.
That's the part I wanted to hear about.
That's the part of it.
The whole building.
And the other thing we're going to be doing is this was originally designed to go down near the Mexican border on the Gila River Indian Reservation, which is a devastated zone that was released by the Indians to some farmers who came in and sprayed it with all these chemicals, turned everything black and left. Can we solve that? So the idea is to go into places where you can't currently, it's desert. It reverses desertification, so that's one of the functions. We're going to be planting millions and billions of trees. There's going to have to be an awful lot of these to affect the climate. And everywhere we go, we're going to be just greening and greening and greening. Everything Charles Eisenstein said at IONS was wonderful and beautiful.
Yes, yes. Our atmospheric processors come to mind.
This is an atmospheric processor. It is a giant air purifier. It doesn't just get the CO2 out. It gets all the particulate matter, all those PM2.5 particles that cause cancer. All of the soot, all of the stuff.
Yeah.
So you have a plan and you see the solution. Now, how do you ground it? Where is it going to be built?
We're at the prototyping and proof of concept stage. Mm-hmm. It looks like funding is finally coming. Some very significant people are taking...
For an atmospheric processor?
To build the first one of these.
Okay.
I would kind of like to do it not too far from Santa Cruz, California, myself. The place that's offering itself big time is Santa Fe, New Mexico. So don't know where exactly. Doesn't matter as long as we do it. And it's designed to be self-replicating. Ultimately, this thing has to be launched in almost a military fashion because...
It looks like it's a habitat, and I know we want to move on.
It is a major habitat for humanity.
Another book.
Yeah.
Well, it could be an income generator for every community if they have one.
How many people can live in this habitat?
How many people can live in a 50,000 square foot building?
Okay.
Depends on how much space you each need. So, okay. And it depends on the people. Some people want to or need a lot. This
that
could be used.
Like
maybe if they tended to the processor.
Maybe 20 some odd.
Well, maybe it's the people who tend to it, live there.
There's that. And we're also going to have an awful lot of refugees if this ocean rises the way it looks like it will.
Yeah.
And some of those are going to be very wealthy people because you're a billionaire, you live on the ocean, and guess what? Your living room's 10 feet in water.
So can this habitat can it be printed with a giant...
It's going to be 3D printed.
A 3D printer,
and it's
great.
Going to be modular because it's going to be a recta set. The whole thing goes up in a week. Well, it's very interesting, this design.
That
it's
is
an exponential business from the ground up.
Well, did you know that where you're standing right now, this building on KSCO was built in 1947. It was originally RCA Studios in New York City, and they replicated it and put it across the country. And this was the first building specifically designed for radio.
And that's what we're going to do. We're going to build the first one. It's designed to be replicated, or it's not
going
to
work. Yeah,
just
replicated.
It's going to be replicated.
Yeah, interesting.
We'll definitely give people
the
URL for more information.
Okay, next subject.
And we want to get Connie's story
in. The last couple minutes your new book,
The Mayflower Revelations. Does this bring the American vision up to date?
Well, so we've touched on our consciousness and our climate aspect. This is our country aspect of our work.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with the evolution of the American mind and the involvement of the indigenous people in that. And so we have a new novel that's a screenplay that's gone to Hollywood to possibly become a feature film. And it's retell from the origin story of a nation that's shrouded in misconception, misunderstanding, and mistaken identity into a story of synthesis, out of victim perpetrator, out of misinformation, into an understanding that there was an intercultural synthesis at the beginning of this
country. So that's kind of what all this immigration is about today, is the synthesis of all of our wisdom from different cultures.
Yeah,
and it's a novel that talks about the people who came on the Mayflower and the indigenous cultures that they interacted with for that first 54
years of peace and friendship, and what came out of that intercultural time together, and that Thanksgiving celebration of 3 days of true celebration, intercultural celebration, that's been totally twisted by revisionist history. Mm-hmm. So we're revising revisionist history to take us
give
into
us back
pride
the real story
of our beginning.
If it works so well for people to get together for 52 years, how come it fell apart?
Well, because it was at a high vibration, and not everybody's at that vibration, at that vision of the leaders who came together and made that peace.
So the founders happened, but the next generation.
Yeah, the next generation, the pressure of time and
ended up in
space
war.
And people and all that. 30,000 people came with the Puritans that came into Boston 10 years later. Everything shifted in 54 years.
So it behooves us to pay attention to the wisdom of the elders.
Yeah, and to the fact that we have come together with the indigenous peoples and created a nation.
That actually
happened. Frame of mind.
All right,
and you write about that wisdom. Okay, well, that's called the Mayflower Revelations.
Info,
can you get that at Amazon?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and how do we reach you guys?
Okay, thetrustfrequency.net.
Thetrustfrequency.net.
First50years.us. And
the climate project is at www.sacredearthenterprises.us.
Okay,
all right.
We'll put
thank
those
you,
on our
Connie
website.
And Andrew.
Yes.
What a treat it's been to be with you guys.
Right? Yes, thanks for being here. Right?
Thank you.
Fit a lot in the hour.
Yeah.
Love it. KSCO Santa Cruz, Dr. Future Show, over and out. Until next time.